From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we meet Dick Traum, an amputee who ran a marathon in 1976 and started an organization that taps the power of what it calls micro-communities.
Virtually everyone has a disability. It may be a physical disability, but it might also be one of, gee, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I'm running, I'm tired. But gee, here's someone with one leg who is running. If that person can do it, I can do it.
Then Milwaukee photographer Corey Fells created an exhibition called the 100 Women Project. We'll talk with him and two of the women he photographed.
And musician John Oates, yes, he of Hall & Oates, digs deep into the roots of American music with his newest album, Arkansas.
What I really ended up doing on this album was kind of creating a bit of a snapshot of what music was like in the 1920s and the 1930s, when really American popular music was just kind of in its infancy.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Training for a marathon is tough, but add a physical or cognitive impairment to the mix, and it can require significant additional support. That was a lesson Dick Traum learned after losing his right leg in a serious car accident when he was 24. Despite his injury, he completed the 1976 New York City Marathon.
His achievement was possible because of the many hours Traum spent with his support system, or micro-community, which included both able-bodied and disabled athletes. Traum says without it, he wouldn't have been able to run around the block. So a few years later, he founded the group Achilles International to help others benefit from micro-communities. It now has 110 chapters in 41 countries.
Traum is the co-author of a book about his experiences called The Courage to Go Forward. And back in November, he joined me to talk about it, Achilles International, and the role small supportive communities can play in affecting change. Dick Traum, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's an honor to be here.
So first off, how did you come to discover your micro community that would become the organization known as Achilles?
Well, we started encouraging people with disabilities to run. And at some point, we're doing things that one would consider to be impossible. You know, several double amputees, for example, out there running quality marathons. And we said, what's going on? What's the motivation behind this? And we talked and we thought, and we decided that the concept is really that of the group or the micro community. And that's the key that is making all of these unbelievable achievements successful.
So go into the concept of the micro community. What is it to you?
Well, the micro community to me is really three or four different groups. It's a relationship between a runner and a volunteer. You know, think, for example, of a runner who is blind running with someone holding a tether. It's also a small group where you go out and you have workouts on a Tuesday evening, and maybe there are half a dozen or a dozen people there. And what's happening is that you're running and you're in a sense competing with other people in the group. And then finally, it's the large group or the Achilles group, where we'll have over 200 athletes running in the New York City Marathon. And that community is one that has tremendous impact.
You mentioned that perhaps there's a volunteer leading a blind runner, there's amputee runners. What other groups of people does Achilles serve, both with physical and cognitive limitations?
Well, it's basically the whole range of people with disabilities. So you might be an amputee like myself. You might be a young person who is on the autism spectrum. You might have cerebral palsy. You may have had heart issues, meaning like a heart transplant. You know, anything, you know, cystic fibrosis, multiple sclerosis, any disability that you've ever thought of or seen is probably represented by someone within the Achilles community.
You mentioned that you yourself are an amputee, and I'd like to note to listeners that you were the first amputee runner ever to cross the finish line of the New York City Marathon. So what inspired you to train for and accomplish this feat, and what relationship did you have with running before and after your accident that cost you a leg?
Well, honestly, the reason I was able to do it was because of the group or the micro community. Prior to losing a leg, my sport was wrestling. And if you know wrestlers, they'll tell you that the runs after a workout are really not appreciated. Running with sport, it was seen as a punishment. And you know, so when I started running, it was a totally different sport than what I had known in the past.
You discuss in your book the first quarter-mile loop for someone is such a monumental deal. What was going through your head when you were running and learning how to use your body in a different way?
Well, the great excitement was that I kept on improving, you know, so that I went out there. And I joined a YMCA fitness program. In order to participate, I had to run. In other words, this was the time that aerobics was being introduced, and they didn't want people coming in and doing the sit-ups and the push-ups and then leaving. And the question was, can you run? If you can't run, you can't be part of this program. So I said, sure. And I discovered that I could take a hop and a step, and I could move. Think of yourself as having a leg with a cast on it, a broken leg, and you're trying to cross the street in the green light, you know, and you have to go quickly, and you sort of hop and step. And I did that, and over a period of, I guess, about 2 or 3 months, I built up to where I could do like 10 to 12 minutes straight. And this was absolutely fantastic because I was able to do close to a mile without stopping. You know, one leg, I can run almost a mile. I was very, very excited. And then I was getting feedback from the group or the micro community, which had never, ever seen an amputee running. And this encouraged me to continue and eventually to do a 5-mile race.
Well, and then 5-mile to marathon from that base level where you saw running as a punishment. Now so many hours are filled with that.
Yes. The thing that's interesting and it's really a surprise is it's more difficult to get from 0 to 5 miles than it is to get from 5 miles to 26 miles. Hmm. You see, by the time I did my first 5-mile race, I was basically in shape. And, you know, again, I had all these friends and support, and I had people who I was almost as fast as, and I would see myself improving. And I had all of this positive energy motivating me to do more.
Now, when did you execute the concept of guide runners? You mentioned you had friends helping, but when did you see the potential of having set volunteers able to help lead people within Achilles during these races?
Well, you know, right from the beginning, so that when I went out and did the marathon, in fact, when I did shorter races, I would have somebody with me. And what that person might do is, you know, pour water over my head if it was hot, encourage me, you know, to walk up a hill, give me some encouraging thoughts. I remember one time it was particularly brutal, and my volunteer coach said, Dick, you know, the next mile is downhill, and we think of this part of the course as the Haagen-Dazs, period. You know, because it's smooth and it's cool. And, you know, it's wonderful to have someone there who is encouraging and supporting you.
And as people who perhaps are not familiar with Achilles see people such as yourself, amputees, anyone running with a partner in Achilles, the runners themselves are getting seen in a different light by the public, but are they also seeing themselves differently, redefining themselves, seeing their disabilities in a different light?
Yes, it's very, very true. Virtually everyone has a disability. It may be a physical disability, but it might also be one of, gee, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I'm running, I'm tired. But gee, here's someone with one leg who is running, and that person can do it, I can do it. You know, I talk about a friend who was running a race up Mount Washington, and the first 2 miles were flat. And these two people passed him and patted him on the back and said, congratulations, beautiful, God bless you. So as he's going up Mount Washington, an amputee is relatively faster than his able-bodied peers going uphill. So he manages mile three and mile four to pass these people, and he comes up behind him, he taps him on the back. He wanted to say, God bless you, too, but he didn't have the nerve.
Well, and with the importance of uplifting people, either through realizing the willpower they have to harness in themselves or through the group, you've always had and valued the importance of working to help others. So how have you honed this passion of yours to translate to the unique partnerships you help to facilitate through Achilles, through Cigna, through the people within these communities?
Well, what happens is that you literally move from being the child, like when you're running in a race, in effect, you're the child. And when you move from being the child to helping somebody else, you become, in effect, a parent. And people, including myself, get more joy out of helping others than they do achieving themselves. And it's a very, very important concept that is just now becoming more visible.
Why do you think it's taken such a long time for that to be a common visible feat?
I don't know, but it's coming out. I'm watching like Giving Tuesday, and people are talking about the joy of giving. And it's actually, I think it's really something that's very American. It's something that we do very, very well here in the United States.
Yeah, your book, you mentioned that both you and your co-author, David Cordani, have a, quote, bleeding heart optimism shared between you both. And with this optimism, you know, I imagine you need that to go beyond the willpower that your members possess. And I'm curious, with any strategy, any training of running a race for anybody, you need a plan of action. And with your plan of action for Achilles, you are with members, you know, from the hospital bed forward, you know, when they're not even thinking about perhaps walking down the hallway. They're saying, you can do this, you can run a marathon. So why was that important for you to have your members in potential new members' lives right away after, you know, a massive life or health moment has happened to them?
Well, you know, from my perspective, it's sort of like a Horatio Alger story. And what we're doing is we're encouraging these folks to become Horatio Algers. A lot of the soldiers went into the armed services because, you know, they were jocks, they were good athletes, and their big thing was sports, and all of a sudden that was taken away, theoretically. And what we do is we come in and we say, no, it's not really taken away. Join us, become a marathoner, and we turn to mainstream sports. And, you know, it's sort of like, oh, my goodness gracious, I wonder if that's possible. What we're doing is we're planting seeds, and we're also giving people an opportunity to achieve. And I think that one of the greatest joys in the world is that of being able to achieve.
Right. That you mentioned the power of, quote, what's next. So when someone achieves anything from a 5K to a half to a full marathon, how do you feel when you see your members accomplishing their first major goal and then being fed with that optimism that you founded this company with, being fed with, you know, new passion, new resilience to be able to do what's next?
It's the spirit of life. I think of Tammy Duckworth. Tammy is a double amputee. She lost her legs in a helicopter, was shot down, and she came out and she started working out with us, and she achieved the marathon, and then she eventually became a congresswoman in Chicago, and she's currently, you know, U.S. Senator. And what she did is she continued to achieve. And I feel that we may have encouraged her a bit by giving her that spark of achievement.
Right. And what do you think the strength of having a simple mission that can be expanded upon easily, you know, how do you think this has benefited you to expand not just in the United States, but around the world?
Well, when we expanded internationally, I discovered it was very, very easy because we're taking a concept that people internationally had never, ever thought of, and it's sort of like, oh, my goodness gracious, isn't this wonderful? And I used to talk about the situation where it was easier for us to set up a chapter in Bangkok than it was to set up a chapter in Brooklyn. In other words, it was a different, it was very, very special and unique. And we just have been very, very successful in terms of our international chapters.
Yeah, what kind of strengths do you think these small mobilized groups have to tackle pressing issues both personally and individually with their members and other wide pressing issues?
Well, I think that what's happening is that we, if you think of a disabled people as a community, we're basically following successes that have occurred with females, with minority group members, in that we're coming back and we're becoming part of mainstream life.
There are many stories and people highlighted in your book, The Courage to Go Forward. Is there any person or example in particular you'd like to share with our listeners of someone who overcame their physical and mental struggles who is now a champion of Achilles?
Well, one is Tom Davis. And Tom lost his leg in Afghanistan, and he joined us, and he started to work out, and lo and behold, he became Paralympic athlete, one of the best in the world, and is sort of like a model for anyone who ever thinks of going out there. One of the stories of Tom is he was doing the Boston Marathon, and because he was very, very fast, by the way, he did it in under an hour.
Wow.
26. Because he's very fast, they decided to put police motorcycles with him rather than bikes, which might not be able to keep up. So here he is, and he's going down mile 21 in Boston, which is a downhill, and he's accelerating well over 45 miles an hour. So the motorcycle police who are accompanying him, who share my sense of humor, gave him a ticket for going 45 miles an hour. They didn't really give him a ticket, but they gave him a ticket.
Right. Well, and that also... aside from the humor, but just the presence of someone on a hand cycle in a major event such as the Boston Marathon, and you know, people reading the stories included in your book, you know, what do you like people of all ages, all abilities, to think about when reading these stories, and what do you want the call to action to be once they close the last page of this book?
I think that the body English is, gee, if these people can do this, I can do something that I didn't think was possible. I'll tell you a story. Going back many years ago, after I lost my leg, I saw a psychologist, and the psychologist was saying, look, Dick, you know, you lost your leg. Well, it's really not that big a thing, and there's virtually nothing that you can't do because you lost your leg. And I said, that's ridiculous. There are things I can't do. And he said, well, go ahead, name one, and I'll show you how. You know, it's not correct. So I said, well, I'll never beat Frank Shorter at the marathon. Okay, some years later, this is 1977, I'm running the second New York City Marathon, my second, and Frank Shorter is running it, and he dropped out at 16 mile, so I beat him in the marathon. The power to do the impossible.
Yes. Well, Dick, I really enjoyed the book authored by yourself and your partner, David Cordani, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share your valuable lessons with us.
And thank you for a great interview.
Dick Traum is the founder of Achilles International and the co-author, along with David Cordani, of The Courage to Go Forward, The Power of Microcommunities. He spoke with us back in November.
After a break, we meet photographer Corey Fells and learn about his latest exhibition currently on view at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Like Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Like Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee artist Corey Fells has given 100 different women from the city of Milwaukee a chance to have their voices heard, although not through sound, but through photography. His exhibition, The 100 Women Project, opened at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in October.
It's a collection of photographs featuring influential millennial women of color that came together over the course of 3 months. From their careers to their aspirations and even their individual struggles, each picture and story gives minority women a chance to share a point of view that many may never get a chance to hear.
Fells, along with two of the women that he photographed, Nadia Johnson and Olivia Burks, and Graham Reed of the Museum of Wisconsin Art, spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell to talk about what inspired the project.
I really wanted to make a story that really is compelling and really told like a real true story about Milwaukee. So the truest, genuine story I thought about that will really connect to a lot of people around the world and the country, I thought would be about minority millennial women, specifically more Hispanic and Black women. Their stories aren't really told as often as like other ethnicities and obviously the male counterparts. So I wanted to just kind of make that very true, genuine story about women that don't really have that avenue to be able to tell their own stories. And I also looked at other projects that did really well, like The Humans of New York, where it kind of really displayed the stories of the city. Milwaukee is a very very unrecognized city in many aspects. And so I wanted to at least be able to kind of stamp that when it came to photography.
Would you also explain how you chose the title? Because when people see it, they'll notice that in the word women, there is an X where the letter E would be, and some might wonder what the meaning behind that is.
I kind of carefully thought about the project because honestly, I wanted it to be about women and only women. And as me being a male photographer talking about that, I didn't really want any male influence or anything to be kind of displayed. And it's also my personality. I didn't really want to be seen as the main voice of the project. And also for it to just mainly be about women. So I put the X there to kind of emphasize that.
And I also understand that the project is inspired by your mom. In what ways did she influence your work?
I am a mama's boy, so it is very simple as that. But yeah, my mom passed away about 8 years ago. 9 years ago today, and she was a huge influence when it came to a lot of different things. My mom, every summer, she would make me read and write a book report for her before I was able to enjoy my summer vacation. So a lot of the books that she would make me read or movies that she would make me watch and then write a whole dissertation about it would be about like Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God or The Color Purple or books in that realm. And she always emphasized to me that there's women in society here aren't really given a voice. They aren't really like talked about or they're not given proper respect. So I just felt it was just very genuine for me to kind of relate that to a project of my own.
What was the process like bringing the 100 Women Project to life? Whether it was choosing the scenery or choosing your subjects, how did you go about it?
First, I just took a walk from work to my house on the east side of Milwaukee, and I just saw this beautiful huge wall with just natural like vines, and it just looked really aesthetically pleasing. But I wanted to kind of make it something that kind of meant something if I wanted to take a photo there. And so I took a few photos of some close female friends that I have, and they're really influential in the city. So I knew if I took photos of them, other women would be kind of more compelled to want to take photos also. So I carefully chose about 10 of 12 women that I knew in certain pockets in Milwaukee, because I really wanted it to be a very eclectic project where different people from different sides of the city were able to kind of feel like they were welcome to join. And allowed those women to kind of tell their stories, kind of tell compelling, very truthful stories that you wouldn't even, you can look at a person and assume so many things, but you don't know what really makes that person or what they really lived through and things like that. So did that, shared it on Facebook. Remember turning my phone off and going to work out for about an hour, and in that Facebook post kind of asked women, hey, if you're interested, I'll be standing outside at this location from 11 until whenever I can get as many pictures, and got done my workout, looked at my phone, and I saw there was about almost 29 shares and a lot of inboxes from women that were really interested in being a part of the project.
So Nadia and Olivia, you were two of the women Corey photographed for this project. What was it like for you two to be a part of it?
I was honored. So I was familiar with some of Corey's work, and I knew that he was an awesome photographer. And I enjoy being a part of my friends' projects in general and just watching my friends grow in their art. And so I was honored to be asked. And I believe when Corey did ask for me to be part of the project, I immediately said yes. And in retrospect, I'm grateful that I am part of such an amazing project. I was thinking about how many amazing and influential, brilliant women are part of this project that are bound for brilliant futures. And, I feel like in the future, I'll be able to hold my head high and say, yes, I was in a project with so-and-so. I was in a project with Olivia. And just be really proud about it.
Yeah, I was also very honored. It's very nice for someone to ask, what's your story? I guess that was what hit me the most and made me feel, very confident as a woman. Because when he asked, what's your story? People don't really take time to ask you, just us as women in general, like, what's going on? And I remember telling him I was in this phase of, working through self-confidence and my self-esteem, and I talked about my sister. And in my mind, I was like, I just want to be a representation for women, and especially women of color. My sister influences me a lot, and I was so happy to have the opportunity.
Now, you're in front of this Vine background, and you have Corey, this professional photographer, ready to take your picture. Did you choose your poses, or was Corey doing most of the directing?
Yeah, so this was I believe this was my first photo shoot, if you will. And I was a little nervous. I, of course, trusted that he's a phenomenal photographer. And so I was sure that he'd make me look okay. But at the same time, I was just nervous because I was like, this is not, my ministry. And so he was a great photographer in that he helped me to relax. He talked to me. And it was raining during my session. And I was like, oh my goodness. I just was able to, relax because he was, talking to me and just trying to take my mind off the fact that I was in front of a camera, and it really helped bring out my real personality. And I think that I was laughing in my picture. It kind of just my quirky self came out. And I was happy about that.
My photo shoot, so we talked. He asked me a couple questions. It felt very natural. And me and Corey actually shot before a couple years prior to this. So I was already comfortable. We already knew of each other. So it felt very natural. Mine was on a sunny day, green background, and I had a very serious look, but it was very comfortable. And he also let us choose our pictures, which was nice. So I felt in total control, not like it was the photographer's eye, it was like the women's eye. So I'm like, this is me and how I want to be represented. So that was really nice too.
Graham, as the director of collections and exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, how did the collaboration with Corey come together?
It actually got started when the executive director, Laurie Winters, actually saw a feature on Corey on TV, I think it was. And then she called me and said, we need to look into see if we can do an exhibition with this young man. But it's kind of interesting, just going back to what Olivia just said and Nadia said about Corey's photography style, was that he let you pick the pictures. And that goes back to when you put the X in woman, I think that's kind of remarkable. A lot of photographers would say, okay, I'm going to take these pictures, but I'll be the one making the final decision. And the fact that Corey basically said, I want you to be happy with the picture, I think that speaks volumes about Corey as a photographer. But we just thought it was such an interesting project because, millennials often get a bad rap. And that this was just this wonderful marriage of not only just the visuals, and going back to the choice of backdrop, we thought was also really inspired. The ivy-covered wall going through the different seasons, as opposed to taking these portraits in a very kind of specific, identifiable backdrop where you were all against different ones, where you're looking at the backdrop going, oh, where is that in town? Or, oh, I know where that building is. It basically put all the focus on the individual rather than the background, but the marriage of the story and the image we found kind of particularly compelling. And you read these stories and they can be so inspiring, motivational, some of the adversity that some of the young ladies have come through. And but it was just very kind of not only just heartwarming, but I think very, very kind of encouraging for the future. I think you look at these stories and you say, yes, there's some really great people coming up through education, through business, starting their own businesses, getting involved with their community, not only their community, but also the wider community as well. So, you know, we just thought this would be a great place to kind of put that conversation on view at the museum.
What are some of the reactions you've either seen or heard from people who have come to the museum and seen the exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, Washington County isn't the most diverse county in Wisconsin. I think it's probably fair to say that. So by bringing this exhibition in, I think it was really exposing a lot of museum visitors to people and environments and stories that they were not familiar with, which is, you know, part of the mission, I suppose, of the museum is to open your eyes to other experiences, other people that you've not been familiar with before.
So, Corey, is this your first time, like, having your work displayed in this kind of fashion? And if so, how does it feel?
Yeah, it really is. I don't think Ram knows, but literally, I think it was around this time last year when he contacted me via email. And I think last year in December, I was trying my hardest to work with galleries in the city of Milwaukee to really kind of show the 100 Women Project, because I think it did garner a lot of like attention. And people wanted to see it in a physical form. And I think that that was the only way of giving justice to the actual project. I think just before that, I was becoming very frustrated for a year trying to work with galleries in the city of Milwaukee, because it was just time just didn't allow it to work out that way. And just before Graham, I think I was going to take a break from photography and just finish up my schooling and finish up my military career and kind of put photography on the back burner. Then Graham contacted me via email and he said, hey, I'm a part of the Museum of Wisconsin Art and I would love to be able to have your project shown here. And that really kind of like gave me a new spark, a new inspiration. And just, you know, it kind of allowed me to be able to know that the culture of photography has a somewhat of a leg or has a somewhat of an avenue to kind of grow here in the city. I'm really appreciative of Graham and the Museum of Wisconsin are kind of reaching out to me.
It also says something. I mean, we live in a very technical society, and there's one thing, you could put all this on Instagram, you could put it on a Facebook page, you could put it on a website, but there's still, I think, an incredible amount of value in walking into a space and seeing a real photograph hanging on a wall. You're not just kind of looking there, you're not swiping it with your finger. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are quite sizable photographs. We actually had to make a very difficult decision and pick 16 photographs for the exhibition. We just simply didn't have room for all 100. But, you know, the fact that, you know, you come in and you see the real object, and the scale is important. And then also for, you know, a young, talented photographer like Corey, having a museum exhibition is meaningful. I mean, that means when he moves on to future phases of his career, you know, people look at his resume, oh, you've had a museum show. Oh, well, you know, that means something, I think. And we were just delighted to be able to kind of give Corey his first museum show.
Yeah, that's great, because people were able to see the transition of me becoming an Instagram photographer to an actual fine art photographer. And there's a group of people that were able to kind of see the evolution happen, so much so that, like, during this past Christmas time, I've had like 3 or 4 cousins tell me, hey, I want to get a camera, I want to do some photography, I want to do a few videos. Even outside video, there's kids now that are in like very rough areas in the city of Milwaukee, like Burleigh Center and things like that. I grew up in those areas too, that are seeing like there's a tangible outlet. I don't have to do all these typical things. Maybe being a photographer is something that's very cool, fulfilling, and especially from a kid that's from the north side of Milwaukee, which is always heavily doubted as a city or area where not much hope or not much aspiration very much happens, that I'm a product of that, and I've wanted to be able to allow other photographers to see that it is possible. And hopefully there's other photographers coming out with projects or just ideas to be able to kind of contribute to this culture or this community here in the city.
Taryn Powell is WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter. She spoke with Milwaukee photographer Corey Fells, the creator of the 100 Women Project, which is on view at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend through Sunday.
She also spoke with Nadia Johnson and Olivia Burks, two of the women that Fells photographed, and Graham Reed of the museum. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then talk with musician John Oates to find out what this half of Hall & Oates is doing these days. It sounds a bit different. You'll hear that when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
One, two, three.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. That's some very pretty guitar playing, but it's probably not the sound you'd expect when you hear the name John Oates. It's something probably much more like this. What I want, you've got, it might be hard to handle.
John Oates still tours with Daryl Hall and is proud of the work they did together. It earned them a spot in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. But these days, you're more likely to find Oates performing with the Good Road Band, exploring American roots music and touring his newest album, Arkansas.
Oates and the band will be in Sheboygan this Saturday at the Weill Center. We reached him by phone at his studio, and he explained listeners shouldn't be too surprised by his current musical interests. You ready?
I'm ready.
John Oates, it is such an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's nice to be talking with you.
And it is so wonderful to hear. It's not brand new music now. Arkansas came out earlier this year, but it is wonderful stuff. And I think for many people who might know you from your earlier incarnations, they might be surprised by the choices.
It doesn't surprise me that people would be surprised. So
yeah.
I get that. I was playing guitar for about 10 years before I met Daryl Hall, and we embarked on our collaboration and our partnership, which, of course, you know, led to all the big pop songs and the big hits. But before I met him, I was pretty much a folk blues musician. That's what I did. I played by myself in coffee houses, acoustic guitar, playing a lot of traditional music. So in a way, this Arkansas album is a real return to my earliest musical influences. And now I understand that people probably wouldn't relate to that because they don't, you know, delve that deep into my history, which I get. But nevertheless, it's still a very, very important part of my musical DNA.
Well, and it is such an important part of rock and roll's DNA. I mean, you're
right.
Talking about Delta blues, and you're talking about all of those black musicians that have woven that sound, and it's what created rock and roll. And you've kind of stripped it back, you know, hearkening back to what they might have sounded like.
Well, I discovered a lot in the process of making this record. It was really kind of eye-opening for me as well, because even though I knew a lot about, you know, the traditional American music in the early days of this, you know, blues and ragtime and things like that, there was other things I didn't realize. First of all, it wasn't necessarily only a black, you know, idiom or black style. I have songs on there that were by a guy named Emmett Miller, another one by Jimmy Rogers, who was the godfather of country music. There was really it was a much more kind of open-ended landscape of pop music back in the earliest days of radio and when the phonograph record player was first invented. So what I really ended up doing on this album was kind of creating a bit of a snapshot of what music was like in the 1920s and the 1930s when really American popular music was just kind of in its infancy. So it led to, you know, you know, in addition to being, you know, the roots of rock and roll, it's also the roots of American popular music. And that's what I discovered as I began the project. And then I got very excited about it and began to, like, look at it as well, this is a chance for not only me to rediscover and discover new things about this era of time, but I think there's a lot of people in America, especially a younger generation, who might not know about music and what American popular music was like before rock and roll.
So when you were delving into all of this music and deciding what you wanted to put on the album, what were some of the things that surprised you that you
learned?
Well,
what happened was the album really began, the idea for the album began in a very, very simple way. I actually was not intending to make an album. I thought that I would go into the recording studio, and I just love to go in the recording studio and do things. I love to work and be creative. But I went in there with the idea that I would record a couple Mississippi John Hurt songs. Mississippi John Hurt was very influential on me as a kid, and I learned all his music in a very accurate way. I had a connection to him, a personal connection to him. My guitar teacher in Philadelphia when I was a teenager was good friends with him and took him around to folk festivals and things, and eventually I ended up with his guitar. It's a long story, but at any rate, I went in to make a few tracks, Mississippi John Hurt songs, and after I did it, I was not 100% satisfied, because even though I could do it, it was like just kind of a, well, you know, it'll never be as good as the original. It was, you know, that was the feeling I took away. But I didn't want to abandon the idea of these songs, and I assembled a band, and I said, I've never heard these songs played with a band. They're always associated with an acoustic guitar and a voice. And so when I assembled this incredibly eclectic, amazing band, the life that they brought and the interpretation that they brought to these older songs just opened my eyes to something else. And I thought, okay, this is amazing, but I think this has more legs than just restricting it to only Mississippi John Hurt music. So what ended up happening, I guess not to avoid a cliche, but the light bulb moment happened when I said to myself, what music was being played on the radio and in the jukeboxes at the time in the late 1920s when Mississippi John Hurt was first recording? And I said, I wonder what he was listening to. I wonder what people around him were listening to. What kind of music might have influenced him? And that's where the album took on a wider scope, and I began to record all these other songs.
The steel driving man named was John Henry. Oh, he went down. He went down. You know that he went down. I'm gonna take this hammer to my captain. Oh, won't you tell him I'm gone? Oh, won't you tell him I'm gone? Oh, won't you tell him I'm gone? Well, it's a long, long way from East Colorado.
That's such a cool way to think about it, because it allows us as listeners, you know, to kind of go into a world that, you know, we wouldn't have any connection to otherwise. Was that a question did you ever meet him? Did you ever get a chance to ask him things like that?
No, but I did see him play live many, many times. When I was in high school, it was, you know, during the 60s, the early and mid-60s, when the folk revival was happening. Mississippi John Hurt recorded between 1926 and 1929, and then he worked on a farm in Mississippi until he was rediscovered in the early 1960s and brought back, you know, mainly to college audiences and folk audiences at places like the Newport and the Philadelphia Folk Festival and various coffee houses. So that's when I saw him play, in the early 60s. And I loved him. I mean, I loved him from the first time I heard him. I thought he was unique. I recognized his uniqueness. He didn't sound like the other Delta blues players. And in fact, he really isn't a Delta blues player. He's basically a hill country or a Piedmont-style blues player, which is really different. I mean, I know I'm parsing it pretty finely here, but his style is closer related to ragtime than it is to Delta blues. So there was just something about his guitar style and his songs and his singing that really appealed to me. And And as I said, I now have his guitar, the guitar that was given to him when he was rediscovered in New York in the early 60s, and I have that guitar. And so it's kind of a connection. I made a full circle connection to him.
That ragtime connection, you're right. When I was listening to a lot of that stuff, I was really into Lightnin' Hopkins. I really loved that sound.
Mm-hmm.
There was a rawness and just kind of a grit to it. But you're right, Mississippi John Hurt had, it was softer somehow.
It was softer. It was a little gentler, but it was also very kind of, it also was like, he had a sense of humor. He had some slyness to him. Some of his songs had very clever lyrics. So here again, he was unique among the blues people who rediscovered during the 60s.
What do you think he would think of this album if he could hear it?
Oh, boy. I would hope he would smile and love it. I hope he's smiling up there in heaven. If Spotify reaches that far.
I just wonder, if he would have enjoyed the opportunity to play them with a band.
Well, I think he would have. I think any musician always loves to try things and experimenting and have a chance to play with other great musicians. You know, for me, moving to Nashville a number of years ago was really a here again. I couldn't have made this album had I not moved to Nashville and made friends and been kind of accepted in the Americana roots music community. So it really all, there's so many elements that came together to make this record what it was.
There's a faded glow along the great river road. One damn farmhouse hanging on a broke down porch, looking over miles and before the clock strikes noon. Don't you know the days and nights? Dreams drift slowly by. Another delta dawn. Hope worth waiting on. Where that old man little flow. The snow white cotton fields of Arkansas here. There's a long black train running on a southbound track. Need that distance.
So what is it like taking it out on the road and having audiences react to it? Have you had any surprises there?
Well, the biggest surprise was that people love it, and I was really happy. I mean, that, of course, makes any artist and any musician, feel good when people respond, positively to what you do. It was one of those things where I just knew it was good, and I just wanted to get it out into the world and play it for people. And the core of the band that I play with live is the band that made the record, which is also that you don't always get a chance to do that. Many times you'll make a record with a lot of studio musicians who don't necessarily go on the road, and so you have to, maybe the sound on stage is not exactly the way it was on the record, but these are the guys that actually made the record. And so they're very deep into the music, and their skill level is off the charts. So playing with them is just, it's fun, it's a joy. They can play anything, and we do everything from the music of Arkansas to other new songs that I've written, to Hall & Oates hits, to some covers of early rock and roll. I mean, we do pretty much everything. And it's just a lot of fun. And it's just about having a great musical experience and telling stories and putting the songs into a context.
When a band cooks like that on stage, the audience can feel it. You know, that's what at least I live for when I go to see and hear bands. It's like, I want to see that connection, and I want to feel that. And when that's happening, that's magic.
It is magic, and there's no way to bottle it. There's no way to describe it. Really, it is what it is, and you try every night to conjure that magic up. And when you have professionals, you can do it on a pretty regular basis. Sometimes it's it's at a higher level than others. But here again, that's the indefinable thing about magic.
There are times I've seen bands where it's at that higher level for whatever reason that night, and you can see the musicians just looking at each other like, wow.
What's happening here? Right, exactly.
This is so cool.
That's true. It's true. It happens to me all the time, especially with this band that I'm playing with, the Good Road Band. They're just so great, and they're great people. We're good friends, and all that, the good vibes really just, you know, it just pours off the stage.
So you got to tell me who's in the band.
Yeah, well, the core of the band is the rhythm section, and that's Guthrie Trapp on lead guitar, Josh Day on drums and percussion, and Steve Mackey on bass. And that's the core of the band. Depending on the show, sometimes some of the other players will join. Sam Bush, legendary mandolin player, he was a big part of making this record, but of course, Sam has his own band and his own tours that he does. So every once in a while, you know, I get lucky enough to have him, but he's not with us on this particular run in January.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, phenomenal
yep.
musician. And yep. I wondered, because I heard some good mandolin.
Oh, that's
there.
Him.
And that was him, yeah.
Yep.
Because, wow, that's great stuff. Well, you know, John, it is so great that you are not only bringing this tour here to Sheboygan, but that you're continuing to explore and you're continuing to create and you're not trying to just relive so-called glory days. I mean, I really love it when I talk to musicians, and there's just so much going on that it's built on all of your history, but you're not staying there.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, I have great respect for the work that and honor the work that I've done with Daryl over the years. And he and I still tour all the time. I mean, we did 40 shows last year together. So there's plenty of opportunity to go out and play the classic Hall & Oates stuff. But here again, you know, that music and the hits and the big hits and the success has given me the opportunity to do whatever I want. So I'm very aware of that, and I don't take it for granted. So the way I look at it is that I want to go out there and do the best I can, because not many artists and not many musicians get a chance to be in that position. And so I don't want to waste that opportunity.
Well, we're so looking forward to having you here in Wisconsin. And thank you so much for taking some time today to talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this band, and I can't wait to come up and play.
Mississippi John, staring at the sun, watching that big kid Allen go slide on by.
John Oates and the Good Road Band will perform this Saturday evening at the Stephanie H. Weil Center for the Performing Arts in Sheboygan. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.